Hello, everyone. Yay, we're live. I'm always excited. I'm always amazed that this works. Matt Higgins with you today, broadcasting live from the third floor of my house in New Jersey. And I just wanted to spend a little bit of time asking questions. I've really been enjoying connecting with the LinkedIn audience and using this time to create content and hopefully share something valuable. My objective is to try to talk to guests and bring people on that I know that have gone through the journey of transformation in some way and from different areas of life, right? Like sometimes it's easy to remove ourselves from an example and say, well, I'm not them, right? I'm not, you know, Matt Higgins, or I'm not Indomitian Sue, and I couldn't do that. And when you bring people on from different areas of life, you realize actually it was just as hard for that person to break through as it might be for you. I remember talking to Julianne Hough about what she's doing to transcend from being on Dancing with the Stars, to at one point being a model, to being a country singer. And now she's her own CEO of an area that she's really passionate about. She's decided to take her passion and turn it into her vocation. And, you know, that's not an easy journey. So my goal with all these sessions is to try to go ahead and, you know, bring people onto the show that are onto these discussions that are in one way or another going through the same thing that everybody out there is trying to figure out, right? How do I navigate through this crisis? How do I endure? How do I stay positive? And then how do I rethink my life? One of the conversations, and I'll just talk a little bit to let the questions and comments accumulate. One of the conversations I've been having with all the CEOs in our portfolio, and there are like 20 of them, is, how do I approach my business now in a world where it's so hard to forecast what's going to happen next, right? So we have a lot of businesses that have brick and mortar locations. Many of them are closed. In the case of Bluestone Lane, you know, 90% of them are closed, or we have 14 that are desperately trying to stay open so we could serve our community. But one of the first impulses that everyone has is I need to rebuild it exactly as it was before, almost in a version of defiance, right? That we need to show that, you know, we're not beaten down. And then after you go through that triage period, you start asking yourself, you know, should I be trying to rebuild my business exactly as it was before? Or should I be saying to myself, I think the more important question is, if I were to build my business today, what business would I build? And I think the same goes through a lot of us personally that are being buffeted by this crisis in all sorts of different ways, probably exposed to things about ourselves that we didn't even realize because we've had so much time to contemplate. You know, for me in particular, working from home, spending so much time around my kids has made me realize just how much time I spend yearning to just get back to them and how much you compromise in life to pursue your career and how you don't always get that balance right. And now that I've been able to be around them for so much, like I don't want to give that up. And I bet a lot of people out there who are watching this right now have discovered little parts about their life that they don't want to give up. And I think that's interesting. And I think we should sit with it. I had Talkspace on the other day, the founders, because I think we're facing a tremendous mental health crisis in this country. And the word mental health still has its stigma. So, you know, I like to think of it as an opportunity to go ahead and, you know, deal with the challenges that start from within, right? That that a lot of us are suffering in silence in one way or another through depression or anxiety or fear. And it all begins by talking about it openly. And I'm a firm believer that there is no shame in this world, right? We spend so much time carrying all this baggage, worrying about what people think about us. And I had a bunch of college kids on the other day and they were asking me questions. And it was nice to connect with 500 college students out there. Can you imagine how they feel, the world they're entering into? And they asked me what's my biggest regret that I'm an old man at 45. And I said, actually, my single biggest regret is every single time that I cared what somebody else thought, right? Because the cruel reality of life is you get to a certain point and you realize nobody really cares, that everyone is so focused on their own problems, they devote about a nanosecond to you and to judging you. And yet you devote so much of your life to judging yourself. And so I was saying to the kids, I think it applies to all of us, is that the sooner that you can go ahead and realize that people just don't care, right? Like we're all trying to figure things out on our own. They are not spending all day long judging you the way you think you are, the happier your life is going to be. So part of the reasons why I want to do this, I want to bring out topics from really interesting people who are going through some journey of transcendence, like many people out there. Somebody just commented, you were a young man at 45. Thank you, Andrew Turner. I appreciate it. And keep the comments coming. Keep the questions coming, because I'm going to go ahead and experiment with putting questions up, and we'll just have a conversation. I brought my coffee. I hope you did as you were instructed. But that there's an opportunity to extract these great stories from these great people, share them with you, and hopefully in some way you draw something that inspires you. I think one of the shames about the way we've handled this crisis as a society is that LinkedIn and Instagram, to a lesser extent, just digital media, social media in general, has given us the opportunity in real time to assess how each one of us individually and each society collectively is handling this crisis. There was never a greater opportunity to crowdsource a solution to a problem than there has been in the last 3 months. And I think, unfortunately, we, in a lot of ways, squander that opportunity. One of the benefits of being an insomniac, I don't know if any insomniacs out there, but you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd find myself reading random studies or reading newspapers from other countries. I know I need to get a hobby or a life, but that's what I do. And so as this was happening in February and March, I was spending a lot of time trying to anticipate what was going to happen in the United States. So I would read, you know, publications in other different countries. And what you saw is that there were real standouts in South Korea, for example. I think it's probably the shining star, but in Germany, little country of Czech Republic with 11 million people, they were all doing something that was very interesting that could have made a big impact in the United States. And I'm not entirely sure why we as a society didn't draw upon those lessons and try to implement them here. And when you look at all those different countries, you see a sort of formula emerges about contact tracing, about rapid testing, and about masks. And I'll still never understood why we took an extra 3 weeks to adopt masks in this country. That's not criticism. I just think we need to hold our government accountable. We need to hold ourselves accountable. So personally, though, there is an opportunity for all of us to learn from the best. The answers are out there on the internet. The answers are out there in this group right here, who are all going through things in their own special way and have something great to offer. So one of the things I just love about being part of this LinkedIn community is the extent to which everyone is mostly positively oriented and is just trying to root for each other. So I'm rooting for you. And I just want to use this platform to shine a light on anything you're going through. I'm actually up here. There's Sarah in the background. She's going to get annoyed that I'm doing it. Where are you? Say hi.
Hi.
Hi. This is my partner in crime, Sarah. It's my wife, who is not sick of me yet.
Not yet.
And so you say. I've learned a lot about myself, apparently. I leave seltzer cans all over the house, which I guess you knew already. But I'm sure... you know, a lot of people are spending a lot more time with their partner than ever before and learning about their relationship. For us, at least, ironically, we're not sick with each other, which I think is really important, right? Are you just saying that because you're live on LinkedIn? So, and I think the most important part is just creating a culture of mutual respect in your home with your partner. And so far, week 10? That's going great.
Wow.
Week 10. Yes. So anyway, I just wanted to introduce you to Sarah. And all right, you can go do your work. You can come on anytime you want. I'm going to start answering some questions. Here we go right here. Let's go to, perfect, from Joshua Hack. I think you could all see it, but just in case, what's the best advice you can give to small businesses to make sure they stand out now more than they ever have? It's a great question. I've been talking about this topic a lot. I think that the number one thing is we're all sitting at home consuming content right now. I mean, I probably wouldn't be doing this under normal circumstances. You wouldn't be sitting here being generous, giving me your time, sitting at home and listening to me. Thank you for joining us. But there's an opportunity to create content like never before and get in front of your target audience and to provide something useful. And I think a lot of times small business owners in particular will feel, well, I can't do that because I don't have anything worthwhile to say. And I think that's a mistake people always make. You think you need to have something revelatory to put out on LinkedIn or Instagram. Well, maybe not Instagram, but you think you need to put out something revelatory here. You don't. You just need to put out something useful and valuable, and not useful and valuable to you, but potentially useful and valuable to your office, you know, to your audience. Gary Vaynerchuk has a book called Jab, 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 Right Hook, where he talks about just give to get. And I don't even think you have to be so transactional. Just put out information that you believe that your audience wants to hear, but it starts with overcoming this fear or anxiety or this sort of self-doubt that you have nothing valuable to offer. So the number one advice I use for small businesses right now is get comfortable putting out content. We're now further along in this crisis, so the world is starting to reveal itself a little bit more. And I think at this point, you probably want to pivot to being a little bit more opportunistic. I think we could see how things are going to shake out. You know, the testing now has ramped up, thankfully. We are seeing the R naught go down in places like New York City to below one. Like, you could start to see ideally our way out of this. Hopefully there's a vaccine as well, or I think we can't rely on it. We have to rely more on contact tracing and on testing. But nonetheless, the world has gotten a lot more predictable for small businesses. So I think you need to pivot from fear and anxiety and triage to being a little bit about more optimistic and opportunistic about what the rest of the world looks like. Because if you wait entirely for the all clear to sound, it might be too late. So for example, on the e-commerce side, I want to make sure that you're using your time to understand e-com. That's not going away. Prior to COVID, only 12% of all transactions in the United States, 12.5%, were done on e-com. That's going to change forever now, right? So I think that any small business that is entirely relied on brick and mortar is making a big mistake. So I think make sure you're using this time. We did a masterclass actually here, not a true masterclass, but what I think is a masterclass with a gentleman named Sabir, who's our resident growth hacker. And you should go through my feed on posts and look it up. If anybody's interested in e-com, Sabir is incredible. And I think that would be a great place to start. So great question. Matt, if you were to start a new business to have a more diverse portfolio of income in the future to mitigate market recessions and fluctuations, what would you do? That is a great question. It goes back to something I just said a second ago. I don't think, I think this has exposed the vulnerability. If you're a purely brick and mortar business, I think that puts you in a very vulnerable position. Omnichannel has become like a cliche word, right? We need an omnichannel strategy, but for lack of a better word, I'm going to use it right now, right? You do need to have some aspect of your business needs to be digital for sure. That's one. That's on the business side. I think that seems kind of obvious. The second point is every crisis opens up an aperture of opportunity. In this crisis, I think the opportunities are in a few places. Sector, it's certainly telemedicine. There were regulatory changes made in the last, 12 weeks that would have taken years to implement. And then in terms of adoption from a paradigm shift, people have now completely restructured their paradigm around expectations around doctors, right? So I think most of our GP visits are going to be done, through telemedicine. And that's a good thing. As somebody who grew up without access to healthcare and spent so much time in the ER, using the ER as my primary physician as a kid, I'm all about telemedicine, bringing more access to rural communities and urban communities and people who have less access to medicine than they should. So that sector has shifted. DTC has completely shifted. I think there's going to be a massive attempt to bridge the last mile. So that's generally a business sector. I think from a business standpoint, though, the way we conduct business, the fascinating thing is the barrier to entry got a lot lower, right? Think about before, if you were a startup, your first impulse was to get a WeWork, right? Or, that was number one, or you go all in and open an office. But number one, you need physical real estate. Then you need to assemble your team, which takes a ton of time because you have to do interviews. There's friction around those interviews. They have to come meet you for a cup of coffee at a Starbucks or whatever. And then you needed to go ahead and talk to investors, and those investor meetings were face to face. They might have been in New York, they might have been California. Because you're in kind of a subordinate position, you have to take the trip and go out to Silicon Valley or New York. That takes a ton of time. Think about the world going forward, right? If I have a great idea right now, of which I don't, to start my own business, think about how easy it would be to get started. I would just, create a backdrop like this. I'd have a logo in the back of me with, Matt Higgins Incorporated. I would go ahead and assemble a team by doing a bunch of Zoom calls and could have a team in place of incredible people within a week, right? I'd have my business plan all done through, Canva or whatever. It would look completely professional. I don't need an office. And now I'm putting my investor hat on. If you want to get in front of an investor, the friction of that meeting and that request is so much lower because I can do it digitally through a Zoom call. And I think the biggest change that happened is, being an investor, that wasn't acceptable before. Like, probably not going to take a Zoom call. I'll do, a meeting for half an hour in the office. I have to schedule it. It might get canceled twice because we all have our own priorities, right? All those things have shifted. And the major shift has become that curmudgeon-y folks like myself, maybe being prematurely curmudgeon-y at 45, would be the ones who would resist having meetings digitally, right? So the decision makers would be the ones who were the last adopters, and that created a lot of inefficiency in the system. So that young scrappy startup has to come see me, or if I'm in another geography, I have to get on a plane and add more pollution to the environment, spend money on hotels. I think all that's changed because every level of CEO, of business owner, of chairman of a board you know, has been on a Zoom call. I love doing a Zoom call with somebody who's like 80 years old, because I'm like, wow, this has completely permeated our society. Here was this asset that was sitting, you know, underdeployed, which is the ability to communicate digitally and make decisions in real time. That asset has been completely deployed in 12 weeks and we will never change. And so I think anybody out there thinking about new opportunities should be saying like, wow, how can I take advantage of the fact that it's not a lot easier. It's a lot quicker to ramp up an idea than it used to be. So if you have been harboring an idea out there and have been wondering, should I really chuck it or should I go for it? Like, I don't know, I need real estate. I need a team. I need a business. You know, well, you still need a business plan, hopefully. You don't need those things as much anymore. And so your excuses and your to starting a business or starting an opportunity or exploring it and your ramp up have gone away. And I think that's really exciting. It's going to take some time, obviously, and we're going to go through a period of tremendous longer period of recovery than I think is being anticipated, certainly than the stock market reflects. But looking past that to some extent, I think that we're going to open up a period of rapid innovation that, you know, is excited at the end of the day. All right, let me put another question up here. Oh, just did this one. Do you think that the perceived value among many executives prior to the pandemic that there is added value to in-person interactions makes sense anymore? Any difference if the meeting is with employees as opposed to potential business partners? Great question, and a little more nuanced than what I was just talking about. I think that in-person meetings obviously have a place. Like, I'm working on a big project that I'm working intensely on, like day and night. And what's amazing is I haven't met a single person involved in this. And these are senior people. These are doctors. These are scientists. These are just all sorts of different folks. I only know them from a photograph and from endless conversations. And so we're developing this intimate, intense, you know, relationship and working on this business together. And yet we've never even met each other. So, and we're now several weeks into it. So I've been thinking about what is the role of a face-to-face meeting. I think that there are certain things you do learn about people when you're looking at them face to face, right? There are little signals and tells that people have. We're primal creatures, right? We think we're using our brain a lot of times when in fact we're just using our emotional intelligence. So I think there is a role to be had in face to face meetings to go ahead and look somebody in the eye and understand, are you going to keep your word? I think those are just more the, you know, relying on human intuition. I think what's good about face to face meetings going forward is that that the bar to having them is probably going to go a lot higher. And the meetings that require a face-to-face meeting, like, you're going to have to get something done. So I have a soccer business. For those of you who are soccer fans out there, we have a huge tournament in the summer, which is a labor of love. We bring every team in the world, every major international soccer team, Man United, Real Madrid, all the big teams. We bring them around the world, and we host matches in the U.S. and in China and Singapore. But to make that business work, everything's face to face, especially like in Spain. You know, we have these amazing dinners, which are amazing. I don't want to give those up. But, you know, like, there's a lot of friction around scheduling travel face to face, which creates a degree of inefficiency, right? You know, fast forward, the next time there's going to be a big in-person meeting, you presume that something's going to happen at it. Like, there's going to go ahead and there's going to be progress. And I think at the end of the day, that's actually very positive, right? They take out a lot of inefficiencies in the market. All right, let's just, Amanda, hello. Hi, Amanda. I talked to Amanda the other night. I remember you. You were on the classroom. Amanda, actually, Amanda has an interesting story. Amanda graduated from college, I think a year ago, and was working in HR at her company. Sorry if I got this wrong, Amanda. They needed help with marketing in the COVID. So she used the word when she was talking to me the other day on this session, saying, you know, I pivoted and now I picked up marketing. And I said, number one, great for you. Number two, something I always tell anybody I'm mentoring is make yourself indispensable at whatever it is you're doing right now. And you will always get promoted eventually. Like, you will always move up. And I think the problem that some people mistake is they're an A player, you know, they're doing great at their job. They get an opportunity, and they get a little frustrated that the recognition doesn't come right away, and they can get a little, you know, bitter or impatient. And I think it's a really important inflection moment in your career. Opportunity always comes before recognition, unfortunately. Recognition is a lagging indicator. Opportunities given is a leading indicator. So you're going to get the opportunity because you're great, And the recognition, unfortunately, is going to lag a little bit. And then you need to be comfortable being assertive and know when your time is right. But you got to be also smart about it. There's a couple of times in my career when I had to sit back, and especially when I was young and I was working in government and I wanted a promotion and I thought it was time. And there were moments where it's like, okay, junior, you know, sit still and be patient. So I was like, okay. And I quit and I went somewhere else and they brought me back 4 months later. And that is about knowing your worth, right? So you have to decide for yourself, where is the demarcation line between being patient and insisting on a sense of justice? And I would always argue better off being a little bit patient and appreciate the fact that you're being recognized. The fact that you're stepping up will create the leverage ultimately for you to be rewarded, but you got to be, you know, patient. So anyway, Amanda, hello. Just was rehashing for this LinkedIn audience, our conversation. In addition to being an investor and having a ton of monetary success, you're also a philanthropist and give back in so many different areas. What would you say you're more driven by, making money or by helping people? Great question. I want to give a completely authentic response. I think, you know, having grown up under such dire circumstances and seen how much the absence of money created such powerlessness in my family, it was important to me as a little 14-year-old kid or 13-year-old kid standing in housing court getting evicted or having no health care of my mother, watching her slowly deteriorate and then die, you know, in absolute squalor. I had decided I will never be powerless and subject myself to those circumstances. So on the one hand, for me, money does not solve problems except the absence of money problems, right? So I know it's a contorted sentence, right? But money does solve the absence of money problems. And there's no shame in trying to create some comfort for yourself, right? So put it that way. One, I think we're entitled to pursue joy and to have money to give ourselves comfort. However, I am ultimately more motivated by what I saw when I was 16 years old, that if you have money and influence and empathy and a degree of power, you can make such a massive impact on the trajectory of somebody's life if you just take a small act and movement in their direction. So when I was a kid, if somebody had listened to those calls for help, and I don't know who the somebody was, but we didn't have, you know, family, but had helped navigate the situation, my mother, she'd be alive today. I'm 100% sure of it. She's had a lot of chronic illnesses. And as a little kid, I didn't have the wherewithal to get us out of that situation, even though I dropped out of school and I was working like crazy. So I can't unsee what I saw as a kid. And I know that ultimately the highest and best use of money, power, and influence after you take care of your own base needs is to ameliorate suffering, right? Like the yield you can get on a simple act of kindness and empathy is unbelievable. Like small little things I do, but I have a scholarship fund in honor of my mother at Queens College, and it goes to single moms who are going back to school. And like two of the women who got the scholarships came to graduation last year when I gave the commencement speech, which was amazing. And I'm thinking, like, that simple little act of a scholarship, which in the scheme of things was not a ton of money, changed the trajectory of their lives. Like, you know, it wasn't the whole picture, but it was enough to maybe make one of those moms a little more comfortable at home, that they didn't have to worry about, you know, feeding their kids that day because they had this scholarship, or making relative choices using your Pell Grant to go ahead and pay your rent instead of buying books. So I'm motivated by both, but the end game I'm much more excited about. Wow, if I continue on the trajectory that I am, and that the things I can do in my life to shine a light on people and ameliorate suffering, I'm really passionate about human rights. I think that we all have a basic right to go ahead and live our lives unfettered and not be subjugated by power, you know, and totalitarianism. And so I care a lot about those power dynamics and to hopefully playing some kind of role in doing something I can about them, because it motivates me. I read a ton about North Korea and, you know, just all sorts of horrible places in the world. I spend a lot of time reading about what people are going through, because I can understand the power you can make in somebody's life who is powerless. So long-winded way of saying, but great question. Thank you for all your questions, by the way. I'm trying to keep up in real time. I just want you to know my brain is split. I'm talking to you. This is the first time I'm doing this, so you got to work with me and be patient. But the comments are coming so fast, so I'm trying to grab them and hold on to them, process them, and be thoughtful. But so, and Keet Lohia. Now, I wish I knew where everyone was from, because I love the international nature of LinkedIn. I can't tell you how excited I get when I get a request. I got somebody today from Belgium. I'm like, Belgium? Haven't been to Belgium. What's going on in Belgium? It makes me feel like I'm taking a tour around the world, and I truly love that. So if you're from somewhere in the world right now, outside the United States, I want to hear from you. I love hearing from you. I love hearing about we should be thinking about what I'm missing. So what do you think would be the situation for international MBA students in the US in terms of internships and jobs post COVID? Mm. That's a great question. One of the things I'm seeing, unfortunately, right now, I taught a course at Harvard Business School with my co-professor, Len Schlesinger, called Moving Beyond TTC, which was amazing. If any of the students are out there, you know, I miss you. I miss being around Harvard. But what I found is a lot of the internships dried up naturally, right? So when a company is going through triage and is going ahead and figuring out how to go ahead and figure out which staff that they want to keep and who they need to furlough, it's very hard to take on an intern, especially in that dynamic when you're making cutbacks, because, you know, it could create resentment, and also you just don't have the time and bandwidth to manage. So the answer to your question is right now is not a great time for internships. It's simply a fact. But that's a window in time, right? Back to my original point, post the 2008-2009 financial crisis, you had all sorts of incredible companies that were born from that crisis that were probably a lot in the social digital space. I think Pinterest was born, Snapchat was born. If I get any of these wrong, I apologize. But a lot, there's a whole, this wave of innovation. There's always a wave of innovation that comes out of this crisis. So the wave of innovation right now is all going to be about remote connectivity. It's all going to be about protecting our society, protecting our indoor air quality, attacking the climate, attacking probably the wrong word, you know, dealing with the climate in ways we should have already. A lot of those areas are going to accelerate now. I think this is going to create a new sort of renaissance period, or a period of awakening that we have to be really careful. This environment is really fragile. It's a little bit around the awareness that happened in the 80s around nuclear proliferation, where we said we have the potential to destroy civilization. Well, now we know we have the potential for nature to destroy us if we are not careful and respectful. So I think that's going to open up a whole new wave of innovation. So my advice to you, wherever you are, is, you know, the United States always rebounds kind of quickly, and we always embrace scrappy innovation. So I think if you give it 6 months to let the world stabilize a bit, you'll find that there'll be plenty of opportunities. How do we think the business of sports will be impacted in the coming months? And are there any trends you are seeing as it relates to the industry? This is a great question. I'd say the area that I have the least amount of clarity on, and remember, we're in a sports business, the Miami Dolphins and my soccer business called the International Champions Cup and Drone Racing League. This is the area that I have the least amount of clarity. And the philosophy that I've adopted is, rather than spend so much mental energy at the moment, if you don't have to, try to figure out what the world is going to be forecast, just watch. Like, I've been looking and seeing how countries elsewhere, because they are a little bit earlier in reopening sports and whatnot, trying to figure out, like, what's, you know, how are they handling? In some places it's empty. It's obviously empty venues. My thought right now is that the world is going to look very different in 4 weeks in the United States. I get this great email every single day that tracks the number of new infections, new hospitalizations, number of new deaths. Unfortunately, has everything that sort of is telling you which direction it's going to. And in New York, for example, you're seeing the metrics drop by about 5% every day compounded, right? So in another 3 weeks, New York is going to feel like a very different place. And I'm using that as a microcosm, because a very significant high percentage of the population in New York will have already been exposed, potentially up to 30%. So presuming that you develop antibodies, as typically the case, there's a lot of people in there who are effectively immune. And what that does is it naturally reduces the R naught, because then, not to be a pseudoscientist, but here I go, but because less people are capable of being infected. So what's my point of that? Like, the world looks very different every 3 to 4 weeks. So if you're struggling asking yourself, like, what, you know, how are things going to play? Some things require just patience and sit back and waiting. So I'm taking a sit back and wait. I'm going to reassess in another few weeks. But in terms of sports generally, I did a poll the other day. Thank you for those who answered, saying, what do you miss the most? I put four options. The first one was date night in West Village because of Sarah. Where are you? Because I do. I miss that. Oh, she left me. Oh, there you are. So number one was date night. We have four options. Concerts. I'm forgetting the third. Oh, movie theater. And sports was the fourth. 40% of people said, I think it's about 40, whatever it is, number one, that sports was the thing they missed the most. So the one thing I'm 100% positive about is sports is going to come back as it was before. I don't see a seismic shift. I don't know how you protect, you know, through whether it's social distancing or there are other measures in place. Things obviously change with the vaccine. So at the moment, I'm just going to take a wait and see approach. Okay. We don't have your name, LinkedIn user, but I'm racing the time to raise fund for a pre-money business model that's perfectly aligned with a change in consumer behavior tourism. Alternatively, I'm trying to find a technical partner to develop the solution. Your valuable advice, please. Well, number one, congratulations that you have an idea that you think is going to benefit in this post-COVID world. That's exactly the spirit. And I'm glad to say you're not sending me that message saying that you weren't going forward. So that excites me. Back to my innovation. I want to address the last part of your sentence first. I think what I have seen in my experience where businesses go wrong is that they don't have a co-founder that they need at the table. And you always have a threshold question when you're launching a new idea, right? Do I have mostly what it takes to bring this idea to fruition? And if I don't, should I hire that skill set, or should I have that skill set alongside me equitized? And there's no perfect way to make this calculus, but the way I do it is that if this element of my business does not work out, right, can I survive at the end of the day? And is this part of the business so essential that I want somebody who's going to live and die for it every single day as a business owner, knowing that they have a chance to make a ton of money or have risked a ton of money to make it successful? Do I need that level of commitment in order for this to be successful? Then you need a co-founder. Bad decisions around co-founders end up being when you're insecure about an industry. Let's say you've never been in the hospitality or tourism industry. You're insecure about that industry, and you decide that you want to, you want to enter into it, but you feel like you need a co-founder who is from the industry. I find those decisions actually end up being more than not the wrong decision, because if you look at like Tesla, you look at some of the greatest advancements. They came from outsiders, right? As far as I know, I don't think I think what's the name? Elon Musk was at PayPal prior to it. And that's where he made his original money. And you look at it, he has no fear of going into new industries. Now we're going to Mars. He's putting solar panels on our roofs. Like that, some of the biggest innovations are made from outsiders. So don't place too high of a premium on subject matter expertise, ironically, because you can hire subject matter expertise. So your second part of your question is, you definitely need to find that technical partner. I assume that there's a technical component to this business. And that's where, again, back to where people make the mistake. I find when somebody's creating a platform business that is, that is about, technology, they say, I'll just hire a CTO, or better yet, I'll outsource it overseas. Huge mistake. If your business is a digital online platform, you should have a co-founder. It doesn't mean they're necessarily an equal partner. You should have a co-founder that's doing it. Back to the first part of your question, I guess kudos that you're doing it. I would make sure that you socialize your idea with the right people. A lot of times I find people are nervous in the early stage to talk to anyone else because they worry somebody's going to steal their idea. It's a great line in the movie Social Network from Mark Zuckerberg's early partner in college. And the retort, supposedly, I'm not saying this is true, but it's interesting. He says, if you had invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook. Right? A lot of times, it's not about the idea, it's about the execution and about the nuances around it. So people tend to be so afraid of sharing their idea that they don't get a good advice. So back to you, my friend, whoever you are, make sure you talk to a few people in the tourism industry or wherever it's coming from to make sure that, that you're onto something, that somebody else is not doing it. Okay, let's see. Somnath Ray. Oh, hey, my friend. I remember. I saw you on a street. And tell me if I'm remembering correctly, electric bike. I'm going to read your thing and see if I was right. I am right. Great to see you, Matt. So I'm from Brooklyn here. Great point on the projected surge of innovation. However, the innovation surge projection may be counterintuitive. Of innovations that let everyone be outside more safely instead of innovations that let us stay and work indoors more efficiently. Foreseeing of innovation in healthy mobility, bicycles, AVs, social robotics. I think you're 100% correct. I wish you were up here right now, but I'll go ahead and hopefully do a decent job about your idea. Somnath has basically invented a battery that gets hooked up to your bike, a battery and engine or power source that enables you to have a little boost of power so you could take your bike on much further distances. This may exist elsewhere, I have no idea, but I just know that he's a lovely guy. And I gave a talk one night and followed me out the door and we went for a walk in Manhattan. And that was a really neat idea. So I know you did a Kickstarter campaign. But I think you're right. The ability to move around outside, be healthy. I think wellness just in general, we've all been inside. We've been a little bit brought to our knees. Our fragility and vulnerability has been exposed. I think wellness is going to be a huge part of what we go after. So, mobility, healthy mobility, I think at the end of the day is absolutely going to be a huge trend. Another LinkedIn user. What is the most important aspect to consider in terms of business innovation in a post-COVID economy? I think you want to make sure that you are auditing your decisions and that you're not overly relying on legacy decisions that emanated from before the crisis. That's a mouthful. But what I mean by that is the world changed irrevocably in the last 3 months. That's not hyperbole, that's fact. So if a lot of your assumptions were pre-baked, don't be afraid to check them again. Like, escalation of a commitment is a huge insidious disease where we feel like we're so pot committed that we can't challenge the assumptions that we made that got us here. Don't be afraid to look back and say, I don't think this works anymore, right? Have faith in your ability to go ahead and iterate and pivot, because you're gonna need that skill set anyway. If you don't have the ability to pivot at a pre-launch phase as you're approaching innovation, you will definitely not have the ability to pivot when you have a large staff and you're facing challenges. So self-awareness, the ability to pivot, is so crucial. Pressure test your assumptions right now to make sure that they were not baked on a world that doesn't exist anymore. So if your business is not fully taking advantage of, you know, even real estate, the fact that I'm just throwing this out there, I think I read this somewhere, Morgan Stanley projected 30% of employees are going to be working from home, right? So, you know, if your business isn't factoring in that phenomenon, even in how you assemble your team, then you're making a mistake. So for example, there might have been the most incredible head of biz dev, but they were located in a different geography, 1,000 miles away, and you had a strong bias against it because you thought, I need to have them at the headquarters because they're gonna need to do all these face-to-face meetings. Well, maybe that's not the case anymore. And now your pool of talent that you can go after has opened up dramatically and you didn't take advantage of it. Same with your real estate assumption. I think my overarching advice in terms of how to approach innovation is to make sure that you, at the end of the day, have gone ahead and re-audit all your old assumptions. So Miguel, I got a question. How do we ask questions? You just ask right there. So when your question pops up, I will answer it. And I'm gonna go to the next one while I let you do that. Stephen Lippold, advice for high school and college graduates, general advice and specific to this time. Yeah, let me make this as specific as humanly. I'll make it general then specific. You know, throughout my entire life, number one, the thing that I could always count on, and maybe I needed to believe it, was that things always get incrementally better. And I think it's an important point for all of us to sit with, especially college students. College students don't know things are gonna get better. I have little kids right now, you know, they're 12 and 13, 17 and 19. They don't know things are actually gonna get better. This to them looks like could be the end of days, you know, and the apocalypse. So I think it's important for all of us who are a little bit older and potentially wiser, or certainly been subjected to more stress, that to remind them that things always get better. And when I gave my commencement speech last year at Queens College, I made the point that in my graduating class at that time, 70% of Americans were against marriage equality. And here I am delivering, you know, the speech that was 1991. I am delivering that speech in 1990 and 70% are in support of it. So setting aside whatever your values are, my values are that is the world getting incrementally better. So we get better in terms of our values and we get better in terms of society. 30 years ago, people didn't really care about the environment as much until Al Gore created Inconvenient Truth. And fast forward, everyone knows we need to do something about it. So the same always happens in a crisis. After September 11th, and I was the chief operating officer of the agency responsible for rebuilding the World Trade Center site in Lower Manhattan, there was a halo of depression and sadness from the trauma of the incident, of feeling like this is gonna, you know, bring us to our knees forever. And eventually we always kind of recover, and people are resilient creatures. So number one, things will get better. Two, I said, you're gonna have to make some adjustments probably. Your dream sector, especially if it was disproportionately affected, maybe it's live entertainment, it may be a lot harder for you to get the job that you want. So try to broaden your expectations and stay focused on your North Star. So what I mean is just have a good sense of what general direction do you want to be moving in professionally? Like, what's your end result? And know that you're so young now that it's okay if you deviate to a different industry. That's not exactly the industry you want to be in, but it's the type of job you want to be doing. Maybe you want to be doing marketing for a sports team or live events, but you know that given the current environment, that's a little harder coming out of college. So do marketing for a cybersecurity company or telemedicine. You're still doing marketing, and you could leverage that to get back to where you want to go. So part of my talk to all of them was just go in that direction. Another important point is that there is no mistake that you can make in your 20s that you can't fix in your 30s. mostly. And I know everyone now, oh, what about this? You know, manslaughter, like, if yes, that woman, you know, anything like that. But other than that, there, anything you do in your 20s, you could usually fix in your 30s. And so I say that because now is the time to make sure you're not being risk averse, right? Like, now is the time that you can sort of handle risk, and you can handle being a little more flexible about where you end up. Don't be too precious about it. You know, consider things you hadn't considered before. So that's a great advice. I mean, great question. I don't know how the advice was. Joan Stone, multiple startups have contacted me to get funding for them. While I have expertise in finance and accounting in middle market companies, what advice do you have for startups raising their first rounds in this environment? Great question. I think I want to give my number one advice I always get. And this is a really an important point. The more you have baked your idea, and the less you're asking me to help you partner on your idea or bake the idea, the more likely I am to pay attention to it, because a few reasons. Under normal conditions, there's only so much I can do, right? And every action has an equal and opposite reaction in the form of an opportunity cost. If I work on your project, I'm not working on something else. So number one, in normal times, I really need to see that, you know, baked. But now, like, it's even more so because I'm spending so much of my energy dealing with my portfolio and working on helping work through those issues, which is where my energy should be. So my point, Joan, is anybody who is an investor still has a lot of their energy being spent on dealing with their portfolio, unless it's the first check they've ever written. And that's probably unlikely unless it's, you know, Aunt Sally, whatever, right? So you want to make sure that you are really, you're painting a picture that you got it covered. And what you need is something very small, discreet and strategic, you know, so that you're not asking somebody else to like go on this big journey. I'd say that would be number one. Two, my advice 4 or 5 weeks ago is different than now. 4 or 5 weeks ago, I said, you know, don't try to raise. Put your round on hold. The world is not receptive to it, and it's going to show up in a lot of maybes, probably, or terms that you're not going to like unless you have a ton of leverage. Fast forward, I think that now that we're starting to see how we work our way out of it, investors are being more opportunistic, more positively biased. Look, the word invest, right, means to put money to work and back people. So, at sooner or later, that activity returns, and that is returning. Three, this is a little bit of return to fundamental values, right? I would always ask, why are you raising money? Like, the idea that money is some kind of validation for your success is out the window, which is good, right? So a lot of times people come to me and I'm like, I just don't know why you're raising money. You know, and if you're all you need to get going is 30,000, that's a lot of money, but you're going to get a lot more respect from an investor if you show that you put your money to work. So back to you, Joan, anybody comes to you, our first question is, have you done everything you can to avoid raising money? Because, you know, at the end of the day, dilution is no fun if you can avoid it. You need partners down the road, but you can go ahead and you can do it. And then lastly, I still think there is a tremendous opportunity to get in front of people who will listen to your story without the friction of an investment being the motivation. So if you have somebody coming to you with a great idea in a small business, I still think they should be connecting with other people who could become evangelical, who could be future customers, who could be investors, without the heavy sell of, will you write a check? I think we're still in that inflection point where, you know, while people are taking a look, it still is better to get in front of folks with your story and, you know, form that relationship. I still delete any email that says, you know, I'm doing a round, it's oversubscribed, $1 million, but I think I can make room for you. It's like, you know, come on. So that's my last piece of advice. Just make sure that anybody you're advising, Joan, is leading with the truth and not trying to cover it up, because nobody expects anyone's business to be in perfect health coming out of this. Okay. I like this one. I'm going to put this up there. Okay. Joan, I have a theory. I believe that a person cannot be successful unless they address their personal demons. Have you explored systemic leadership and our family constellation therapy? I don't know what family constellation therapy is, but I bet I need it. But I love your question, right? I always have, there's many different ways to say this, but I think I could identify a material problem in almost any company and trace that problem all the way back to the top. Material, not any kind of problem, right? Because if that weren't the case, right, that would mean that leadership had no consequences. And so I am a firm believer that whatever we are dealing with personally and we're struggling with will show up eventually in a business. And without getting into details, at times in my life when I struggled, I made some of the worst decisions of my life. And had I just been given permission, even given myself permission to talk about what I was going through, I would have mitigated those bad decisions. So I always remember, I'm a cancer survivor. I hate using the word survivor. It's like tempting fate, but I am doing fine. I am winning the battle with cancer. And I remember going through it, I thought, interesting how life brings you to your knees, and you remember the times in which you were not charitable when somebody else was going through something. And when I went through cancer and radiation and all these sorts of issues, I thought, well, like, wow, my decision-making is really impeded. And if I have to cover this up, or if I feel vulnerable that like I'm gonna lose my job because I'm infirm, I'm gonna make very bad decisions. So I feel very passionate about the idea that shame and baggage actually impedes us, you know, acting at our best, but we don't create a lot of space in society to talk about it. So hence the reason I do. And then back to your bigger question about success, when I do a deal, oftentimes I will rely on industrial psychologists, a woman named Laura Finfer. She's like family. She's been with me for almost 15 years in one capacity or another. She did a 360 review of me when I was very young and revealed all these things that I thought I had done a good job concealing about weaknesses and opportunities and my leadership style. And I thought that's really interesting, actually, that with given enough time and data, you can really figure out these opportunities. To me, it was like being given the answers to the test. So I am really passionate about the idea of, even in the diligence phase of doing a deal, is really understanding what makes a person tick, so that at the beginning of a deal or a partnership, you could put those issues out on the table and then you could reference them, right? So if I have, you know, issues that stem back from childhood and I tend to get very anxious in a crisis because I feel like it's all going to be taken away, not to get totally psychological, but those issues are really important and they could derail progress. So I think it's back to what I always say, that I think self-awareness for anybody, but particularly for a leader, is the greatest arbitrage that is entirely within your control to unlock, right? Self-awareness can be cultivated. And what usually gets in the way of self-awareness is fear. You're afraid to look inside and you're afraid to be revealed. So if we work together to create a culture where there is no shame about acknowledging and there's no shame about seeking support and help, then I think, you know, everything starts at the top. So I love your question. I don't know about family constellation therapy, but I'm a supporter and believer of all theory. You're getting a lot of cheers. Shirley Green just said, I'm so thrilled you asked this question. Little props, throw you up there. And let's take two more. Let's ask this. Hi, Pamela. Hello, Matt. Our small business is looking to expand globally in terms of sales while keeping our sustainability. We are looking for advice and information and confidence. That's a great, great question. Well, first thing, you're on trend, right? I think more and more accountability is going to be demanded out of companies that are operating globally. You know, even Amazon. If you saw what Amazon did with what's the name of the shoe company? Honey, what's the name of the shoe company? The shoes I like.
Allbirds.
Yeah, sorry, Allbirds. Right. So Allbirds. You know, Allbirds has got these great value system. They've done a great job with their shoes, and then Amazon went and knocked it off, not relying on the same values that Allbirds deals with in terms of supply chain, in terms of materials. Bull and Branch has built an entire business in the linen space about creating their own supply chain based on fair trade, right? So I think what's going to happen, and this is actually brought up by one of the students in my Harvard business school class. If you're out there, you know who I'm talking about. That we're probably going to use blockchain so we can go ahead and track every element of a good, and we can determine whether or not that product upholds our values, right? Where did it originate? You know, was it a fair trade factory, etc.? So your desire to maintain sustainability, in terms, if we look at verticals of where our values are going to be, sustainability, fair trade, and so forth, that you should be designing your business with sustain. I would argue that it's not an option. It's not an aspiration. It's a bona fide requirement. So great. And I would argue that when you're doing this, you should look at people who've done it before. I bring up Scott Tannen at Bull and Branch. Scott Tannen is the name of the founder with his wife, Missy. What they did at Bull and Branch is so extraordinary because they looked at an industry where the labor practices were horrendous, right? And sort of, we were, you know, ignorant about where our cotton's coming from and just not really paying attention. And they said, not only can we do this the right way, we could do it in a way that is very profitable. And they did the hard work. They went to India. They created their entire supply chain themselves and they built a very profitable company. So my point is, you can have sustainable principles and fair trade principles while making a profitable business. But in this next wave, right, every customer year by year, more and more, is going to demand that a company live its marketing, right? That the Everlanes of the world, which is built on transparency, that all these kind of, it tends to be a DTC phenomenon, direct to consumer business phenomenon, where they build these brands on strong values. I think we're going to demand strong values of all of our companies, all of our brands. And as we get more and more connected, information is disseminated, we're going to be able to hold them accountable. I think blockchain will end up being the answer as to how we do it. So great question. You're doing the right thing. In fact, it's the only choice you have. So let us do one more question. I really enjoy this. Let's see. This is a specific fact, but hello, Darcy, Mr. Darcy Silver. I've invested $200,000 in startup technology development in Israel. I'm making a pivot to expand the value and disrupt this specific industry. I received a quote by an outsourced company overseas for $25,000. Seems to be good to true. Is it worth it to create two teams building identical platforms? Well, I think this one is easy. It's too good to be true. I mean, it's just a fact. Now, in the event that maybe you and I are both wrong and we're paranoid, LinkedIn gives you a great opportunity to go ahead and help vet where that's coming from, right? So the good part is, in terms of reference checks and figuring out who's telling the truth and who's a good partner to deal with, LinkedIn should give you the ability to go ahead and figure out. So somebody out there right now has the answers to that company that bid you way too little money. But when things are too good to be true, they're always too good to be true, and they're not. Let's answer another one. Steven Tiberio. Hi, Matt. Thanks for doing this. What are the best learning resources you have used over your career? Is experience much more valuable? The answer is, I think experience is much more valuable, number one. Two, what I love about coming of age in this time, I'm again dating myself, but I grew up with the Encyclopedia Britannica, right? I would have a collection of encyclopedias on my desk. I would, as a little geeky kid, I would go to the library and I would pull up microfiche from old newspapers, and I would read about different crises throughout history and just try to learn patterns. And that was my version of the internet. Fast forward, the answer to every question that we are dealing with already has been answered on the internet, which is amazing. Gary Vaynerchuk likes to say, Google is your mother. And it's kind of true. So back to my original frustration about why the way I just feel like we didn't handle this crisis correctly is that we had in real time case studies of how people were handling it in a different way than we were, because they had been through SARS before. Like, go back to South Korea, using that example again, they had been through the trauma of an outbreak, and they were able to implement immediately rapid widespread testing, contact tracing, everything that you would need to contain the virus. And if you look at the statistics, they've been able to keep fatalities at a fraction of what we've been able to do. So what's my point of that? My point is, the answers to every question you have are out there somewhere on the internet. I read a lot of primary source material. I'm always looking, every time I have a question or struggling with something, I look for a study to validate it, you know, on every kind of topic. It's a little crazy. Like, I remember one time I couldn't sleep before a marathon and I was so frustrated. I was in Paris, was freaked out. And I thought, you know what? I bet you somebody has done a study about sleep deprivation and marathon performance. Sure enough, somebody had. It was some Danish cyclists. And it turns out they did just fine. So I did just fine. So, you know, there's information is out there, Stephen. And I think I'm a big believer in first accepting the fact that there is a very few novel questions, and take the time to go ahead and find it. That's another point. I do believe in identifying a few people that you really respect and value, that you want to try to emulate their formula or extract pieces of it. For me, that's Warren Buffett, not because of the end result of being the richest guy on earth. That's not the case. It's how he did something I aspire to do, which, as he moved further and further up the different rungs of success, he continued to define personal satisfaction and his needs as narrowly as possible. So just to unpack that, I believe that, you know, to be truly successful in life, you want to play with a free hand. And you want to do everything you can to minimize fear and risk aversion. And the way you do that is to make sure, as you accumulate more success, you become less and less afraid of losing it, right? So for me, I define success as my family, my wife, my kids, my house. These are the things I really care about. you know, my friends, if I lose everything else, as long as I have a base amount of money, I will be fine. That enables me to play with a free hand. So Warren Buffett, you know, he lives in the same house. I don't plan to do that, but he goes to McDonald's drive-thru every day and has a simple little pleasure. So for him, his little breakfast egg McMuffin with cheese is his simple joy. He does that every day. You know, he never strayed from his values that matter to him. Number one. Two, he reads 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day. He just reads. He doesn't pack his schedule with meetings and whatnot. And you know, as you go on in life, you realize it's knowledge accumulation and pattern recognition is the key to so much success. So the information is out there. If Warren Buffett was able to accumulate that information when there wasn't an internet and understand where to put money to work in value companies, we certainly are able to do that now. So back to your question, the best learning resource, in my opinion, is to find a couple of people that you feel like did it the right way and you want to try to emulate how they did it and draw. And it usually it's something that kind of resonates. It's probably not something that is prosthetically installed in you externally. Oh, I'm going to copy what that person did because they did well. No, it's because they kind of resonate with me. I connect with what they're doing on a soulful level. And so I want to learn a little bit more about how they did it, right? I'm not talking about Warren Buffett because, you know, I picked him. I'm talking about it because it made sense to me. So back to learning resources, you know, number one, the information is out there. I don't believe in any particular platform. I believe in asking a problem and a question and then go finding that it already probably has been answered somewhere, usually in scientific research before it's widely adopted. And then to find somebody that you really admire that resonates and try to go ahead and you know, learn how they did it. Ah, let's do one more. I'll do the last one. Can you host us again? If you want me to, I will. I really enjoy it. I've really enjoyed connecting with people. It's been cathartic for me. I have no particular agenda other than I just enjoy it. And I have a little bit extra time, although that's not true. I find myself working from 6 a.m, 5 a.m. till 10 o'clock at night. But I want to connect with people and I like putting it out all there. Again, my main message to everybody today is there is no shame. You will, if you haven't figured this out already, you will. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody's spending nearly as much time judging you as you are judging yourself. Like the ratio is probably 1 to 100. And that'll be one of the things you regret when you look back. So if we could all collectively expunge that from our psyche and just not care, just let it go. I think that we'll just be happier, so much more successful. So hopefully by these sessions, and I'm going to continue to do them, that I put out information that you can be inspired from and just realize that everyone's human. Everyone's going through the same struggles. So, in the next couple of weeks, I'd love to hear in the comments, anybody you think that you'd want me to talk to. I'd love to hear that. I'm going to be talking to Robert Herjavec again, wonderful guy. He's on Shark Tank. He's just got a great soul. We're going to talk a little bit more about self-care and about mental health. I have an amazing guest coming up to talk about that. But I'm open-minded. I care even less about specific people and more about topics that you think would be good to extract and bring a light on. And I'll work to try to get them on here for an hour. So thank you, everybody. I apologize to everybody I didn't get to. I'm going to scan the comments later and see if I could find time and answer. And again, it's been really great spending time with you. Enjoy your coffee and have a great day. Bye.